Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. I'm Ruth Anna Marte Fio, and my first guest tonight is Patrick Labaugh. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, I want to say hello to everyone out there, especially my friends at the NSA who are listening.
Oh, right. Well, I hope that it's been cooler for them than you in South Carolina.
100 degrees, it's a walk in the breeze.
Okay. Well, I guess after Iraq, probably.
Probably.
But it gets cold in Iraq too, doesn't it?
Well, not where I was. I was in Basra, which is in the southern part of Iraq. It's desert and it's pretty warm. But at night it does get cool.
It gets cooler at least at night. Yeah, that's. Mm-hmm. But okay, so 100 is a walk in the breeze. Okay, good for you. You can find more about Patrick and one of the organizations that he represents at www.socialistpartysc.org. And, you know, I would just like to ask you to define socialism for us in your own words. So many people in the United States, anyway, look at it as a four-letter word. In fact, I have several friends who think that. And, you know, socialism, communism, any kind of ism that isn't capitalist, it's got to be bad. And we were taught that, though. So what is your definition?
The easiest definition of socialism, I always like to use this definition. Capitalism is about capital making money. Socialism is about organizing the social order for fairness for all.
Okay. That's short and sweet and very true. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted. That doesn't mean what?
Well, it doesn't mean there's no private enterprise. It doesn't mean there's not small businesses. I spent some time, a few weeks in Vietnam back in 98 in Ho Chi Minh City. And Vietnam is a socialist country. But everywhere you go, there were street vendors. There were private shops. But there were no large corporations ripping off the workers kind of thing. Under socialism, there's more of an emphasis on the public square. In other words, energy, these things are run by the government for the benefit of the people, not for profit. And, of course, healthcare, which is the biggie.
Yeah.
You know. But there's free enterprise under socialism. There's enterprise. Let's put it that way. There's enterprise under socialism. There's private ownership of shops and small businesses, and you know they have a thriving economy in Vietnam right now because of that, because they've balanced the idea of yes, people have to have incentive and they can make money, but the government regulates it so they're not ripping off the consumer, so they're not you don't have these fat cats at the top, so to speak.
Right. Okay, well, now, in Vietnam, since you were there and got to really look around, do they have, like, the worker-owned co-ops that we talk about Mondragon in Basque area of Spain, does Vietnam have that type of setup or not?
I wasn't really exposed to that, so I can't really tell you, but I know there were co-op farms similar to the kibbutzes in Israel, which are co-ops.
Right.
But I'm not sure about, like, I know what you're talking about. In Spain, they have these corporations that are owned by the workers. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they have that in Vietnam or not. I really wasn't exposed to that.
Okay. Well, now, but you did touch on something that, I mean, I, being taught in American schools, or not taught, I was one of those people who thought, oh, well, with socialism or communism, there is no there's no room for small shopkeepers. And I come from my parents had their mom and pop store. I grew up in it, and so you know that to me that was just like, well, there's no room for anyone with their own enterprises or creativity. Everybody just toes this line, and everybody's all the same kind of thing, because that was the way that we were taught. But it's nothing like that. And in
Well, I was going to say not true socialism. I think what we were taught in schools was the communist model of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe when they went into communism, which technically really wasn't communism. It was statism.
Exactly.
And that was the model we were taught about socialism. And I always go back to people when they say, well, you know, the Soviet Union was called the United Soviet Socialist Republics. And I always say, well, if a dog calls itself a cat, it's still a dog.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can put whatever label on yourself. It doesn't make you necessarily that.
Yeah.
You know, Hitler called himself a National Socialist Workers' Party. They weren't anywhere near socialist.
Yeah.
So,
that's a very good point. I've heard people talk then about socialism, like the automation socialism and different things. When that happens and people don't need to work so many hours and, you know, that everything is still fine, they're going to have actually more time for creative endeavors and spending time with your family. And like you said, the public square kind of thing, but people helping people instead of this, what we have now, because so many people are so wrapped up in their own little world just trying to get by. And I'm not knocking them. I mean, they're trying to feed their family, whatever. But it doesn't leave much room for thinking or doing anything outside of work.
Well, if you look at France is a good example. France is in many ways a socialist country, although we don't always hear that. They have a four-day work week. They have universal health insurance. They have the ability to go to college if your grades are good at no cost or very little cost. You know, everything isn't a profit motive. I think the other way to look at socialism is that society isn't based on the profit motive.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that makes a major difference in the way society is structured.
Right. You can take any area of our world today, in this country anyway, like foods, okay? We're not going to get into GMOs, but that type of thing, the highest payer, which is like Monsanto, DuPont, all of these, have paid off, lobbied themselves silly, and are still producing GMO crops, which like 50 countries in the world have banned, but because of the profits, it's still going on here. Obviously, the government isn't caring about the health of the people. Now, with the socialists...
Congressmen and senators are in the pay of these companies, the Monsanto and the health care insurance companies. You know, we're never going to have universal health care in this country, I don't think, because the pharmaceutical companies and the HMOs and Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is the largest health care provider in the country, they spend billions, literally billions with a B, on lobbying efforts in Washington. And unfortunately, the workers, the working class, the middle class, the people on the bottom, the 99%, don't have the lobbying power that the 1% has.
Right.
And, you know, with the exception of people like Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, you know, and a few others in Congress, most of them are in the pay of these big corporations.
Yeah. And I'm sure you recall that Obama had talked about doing away or cutting way back or something on the lobbyists in D.C., remember?
Yeah. He talked about a lot of things when he was campaigning.
Exactly. I mean, that was just one of, you know, the things, because it's like, okay, well, that sounded nice. And then nothing, we've got more than ever. And they're paying off more people with more money than ever. So, the 99% doesn't have the funds to bribe people, because that's what it is. Go ahead.
And even if you look at campaign reform, and I will give this to John McCain. I'm not John McCain's biggest fan, but I will give him this much. He tried to get campaign reform and, you know, with the idea of public financing of campaigns and these things and limiting donations of corporations and things. And, of course, he was shot down completely. You know, that was completely shot down because of the status quo.
Right. It's hard to have somebody voting against their paycheck.
And, you know, a good example of that was the recent special election here in South Carolina that everyone around the country heard about, Mark Sanford. But both candidates were in the pay of big corporations, the Democrat and the Republican. They had millions and millions of dollars poured into that campaign by big corporations, big lobbying groups. You know, when you have this kind of money floating around, it makes it impossible for the little guy to, you know, our founding fathers envisioned our Congress and especially our House of Representatives as being the people's house of the average everyday guy, the farmer who went up to Washington for, you know, 4 months out of the year to pass bills, you know, to pass laws, to legislate, and not as a career.
Right.
And you know, that's, of course, that's gone by the wayside. Now it's a career, you know, and these guys, the minute they get elected, I had a very good friend many, many years ago when I was very young, who was a congressman from Rhode Island, Ferdinand St. Germain. He was a Democrat from Rhode Island. And he said he was a house painter when he got elected. So the minute he got elected, he had to stop fundraising for the next election.
Yes. Which is another reason for term limits. That's why I say that we should have either stick with a 4-year term for president or 6-year term and only one term, because we see the whole time during the first 4 years, the president is campaigning for the next election. And
you know, in the Philippines, they elect their president for 6 years one time.
And where is this?
That's all. In the Philippines.
Oh, okay, right. And I think that's excellent. I mean, I'm okay with 6 years, but it should just be one. We were talking about the lobbyists, and I wanted to add that a few weeks ago, Brian and I on Progress Toward Democracy had Jack Abramoff on. And, of course, now you consider the source, okay? But he was saying, and it probably was true, that a lot of the our senators and representatives who do take money from the lobbyists, money and perks, whatever that may be. He said they don't really look at it as bribery, and they don't really look at it as they're doing something morally wrong. And I think that may be the case. Not all of them. I mean, some of them are just flat-out crooks all the way. But some of them, I think, don't see it quite in such a negative light.
Well, you know, I'll go back to talk about the Philippines, because that's kind of my second country. My wife's from there. I own property there. I'm going to retire there, actually. They actually put one of their former presidents in jail for bribery. And, you know, we don't put former presidents in jail. And, you know, if anyone deserves to be in jail, George Bush and Dick Cheney deserve to be in jail. That's a whole other show.
Yeah, it is. But no, that's true. And that's why they've in, was it Indonesia or Malaysia? Oh, several months ago, they had a trial. Of course, I mean, it probably never made any mainstream media, but we saw it a lot on the internet, where they found Bush and Cheney guilty of war crimes and things. You know, I mean, other places have recognized the fact that they are war criminals.
Well, Burlington, Vermont has indicted Dick Cheney for war crimes, so if he ever steps foot in Burlington, Vermont, he will be arrested.
Ah.
And the chief of police, this was about 2 years ago, the chief of police said that he was indicted in the municipality, I believe it was Burlington, it's up in Vermont, and chief of police said that he had to arrest him if he ever stepped foot there because he was indicted. There was a bench warrant out for his arrest.
That's wonderful.
But you can imagine Dick Cheney ain't ever going to go to Burlington, Vermont.
Right. I mean, it's just nice to hear, but of course, he had no intentions of ever going there. But still, and I think some country in Europe, didn't they do something about Bush? Didn't they put something out not too long ago?
I want to think it was Spain, but I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I'm not sure. I think it was Spain or Switzerland. I'm not sure.
It was the same kind of thing. I mean, if he lands there, but, you know, there's all the other countries in the world we can go to. But still, it just sort of, you know, makes us smile because at least somebody is coming out and saying, well, you know, we just won't accept it.
It amazes me that people in this country hated Hugo Chavez. Okay.
Oh, one of my heroes.
Yeah, exactly. When he called Bush El Diablo, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. But
yeah,
it amazes me how brainwashed people are by Fox News and by the mainstream media that he was such an evil man, and yet at the same time we had a president like George Bush who went into Iraq. Not only did 4,000 Americans lose their life there, and I was there, I know firsthand about Iraq, but not only that, 1 million Iraqis lost their lives. One million.
And there's still, I mean, there's still the soil is so contaminated in so many places, and children are still being born with birth defects, and they don't know what's going to happen to all the other people. So that 1 million figure of just like instant death, I mean, it's really so much bigger, the damage that we did.
All for so-called weapons of mass destruction that were never found. No one's saying Saddam Hussein was a nice guy. I'm not saying Saddam Hussein was a nice guy. But there are a lot of bad fellas in the world, and we don't go after every bad fella. The thing is, if you're a bad fella and you got oil, then that's when we have an excuse. You know, and now they're talking about going into Syria, and, you know, and again, Assad's a bad fella, but why are we getting involved in country's civil wars? How would we have felt in this country had France and England invaded this country during our civil war?
Well, that's the whole thing, and I'm not saying that Assad is the greatest person on earth either. But I do have a lot of Syrian friends who say, you know, get the whatever out. We'll take care of our own business. And then I do have some who are very supportive of him, but many others are supportive of the government, and they just think they'll take care of it. They don't want the West there at all.
I have a friend from, well, he's from Lebanon, actually, but he's Druze, and there's a lot of Druze in Syria. You know, Druze. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them, but they were very supportive of the government, and then Assad turned against them, and actually wiped out several Druze villages in southern Syria. So Assad's not a nice guy. But again, why do we go into these countries and fight their civil wars? I mean,
We're trying to destabilize them. Because, you know, this is destabilized them. Now, Iran is a friend of Syria's, and since we're, you know, looking at them that way, it seems like to destabilize Syria and totally mess them up so they can't help Iran either is part of the plan.
Well,
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of subtleties, but that seems to be one of them.
When you look at the map, you look Iraq, Afghanistan, what's in the middle of Iraq and Afghanistan? Iran.
Yep.
I mean, just, you know, when Bush came to power, one of the first things he said, we're not going to nation build. And then what did he do? Tear down the nation to try to rebuild it, right? I mean, why do we say, I mean, I like democracy. I really do. okay? You know, we couldn't have this show on in a lot of countries in the world.
Exactly.
In Red China, this show wouldn't be on the air, okay?
Right.
So I'm not anti-democracy. But why do we say, okay, our system's so good, so we want to put it on top of you, and we want you to be, because if you don't agree with us, then you have to, you know, we got to make you like us.
Right.
So
I don't
we go in there and...
Why? We don't
and,
care.
You know,
I was just going to say it's not about democracy. It's about supporting the corporations that are there to steal the natural resources.
And it's the industrial military complex. The defense industry doesn't have money if we're not at war.
The whole war machine, exactly. Has nothing to do with democracy or humane issues or anything like that. If there's anything that's humanitarian done, it's an aside. It is not the reason for being there.
I'll give you another example of that very thing. In Iraq, during the Iraq occupation, every one-third, every one person out of three, was actually not a military person, was a paid worker of Halliburton or of these other corporations that went in.
You know,
when I started out in the Army, and I was in the Army Reserve for 23 years, when I started out in the Army had its own cooks. That doesn't even happen anymore. Corporations come in to cook the food for the military. The support systems are all corporate now.
Patrick, I did not know that. I know what they've done to the prison system and, you know, like prison corporations or America and all that, everything is. I did not know that the Army doesn't do its own. See, that is just bullshit. Truly.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, these subcontracts, these military subcontractors, Halliburton supplied all the food in Iraq. Now, I don't know stateside. Maybe there are some Army cooks. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to make a general statement, but I'm telling you, like, in Iraq, it was all Halliburton people. It was all, you know, these corporations go in. And let me tell you, they pay these people who work for these corporations big bucks. A security guard for Blackwater made an average of $100,000 a year, whereas a soldier in the same job would make, you know, let's say they were an E4 or something. Okay, they would be making maybe 40,000. So these corporations are racking in the big bucks.
Wow. There's something just really, I mean, besides being morally wrong in the first place to go and try to overthrow somebody else for no real reason, not counting the lies, but still then there, and then the corporations are really in charge, because the corporations are in charge of our government, so of course they're in charge there.
Exactly.
That seems
they run the show.
Yeah. And that's one thing I've been so impressed with the people that I know that are socialist and communist across this country and around the world. They're so into peace. And just because they know it's a better thing for all living beings, you know? I mean, if we're not killing each other, we can be doing fun things and making things better.
The whole purpose of the military, and again, I served 23 years as a commissioned officer in the military, so I'm speaking from a military viewpoint to some extent. The whole purpose of the military is to keep the peace and defend our country. That is a good thing. We need a military. I'm not advocating no military, but we misuse our military so much for corporate gain, for these different things, that our military almost becomes meaningless. I mean, the people who are serving, you know, I met over my years in the reserves and in several deployments to different places, I met some of the most wonderful people in the military who are serving because they believe in their country and they want to defend their country. But they all almost to a man and woman, say, why are we over here doing this? How is this defending America?
That's
why
are
we in Iraq?
Yeah, yeah. If somebody, I mean, I agree with you. It would be good to have some kind of military, and they can stay here, and if we're attacked, they can do some, whatever. But for us to go someplace else and start interfering in people's business, and I've had people tell me, well, all those Muslims, they hate us. And I say, you know, get your head out of your butt. It's like, you're so wrong. You've believed the mainstream media. They don't hate us. They hate our government. I hate our government. I mean, so they don't hate us.
And, you know, military people will be the first people who have been in battle, and I have been, at least at the battle lines. I won't say I've been in battle per se because I was a nurse in the military, but I've certainly seen the results of battle, and I've worked on people shot up, and I've actually been shot at. But
right.
Military people who've been in those situations, they are the most biggest peace activists there are.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we know the horrors of war.
Yeah.
And we don't want to see that. You know, when I was in the military, yes, they called me to serve in different places. I went. Don't get me wrong. But it's not like you go gung-ho, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go and do this. You know, that's not the attitude. That's Hollywood's attitude. That's
yeah.
The John Wayne movies. That's the, I saw on Memorial Day the John Wayne movie about the Green Berets, and I thought, yeah, it's such bull crap.
Yeah.
But that's not the way people in the military view things. I mean,
yeah.
The people in the military view things more like the old movie MASH and the old TV series MASH.
Oh, I love that. I love those reruns. I mean, yeah. That was...
And I served in a MASH unit, and actually that, of course, it's not as crazy as that, and it's not quite as unmilitary as MASH,
you know,
because Hollywood does this thing. But actually, a lot of that is very realistic. The attitudes, the when you see them in the OR and these different things on MASH, I've seen that firsthand in real time, in real life. And MASH is actually very realistic compared to some of these gung-ho movies, you know.
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned it, because I wondered, because it like you said, I mean, it's more comedic and all than it would be in real life, but they actually, they tried to tackle a lot of issues and still keep the humor going, but there was a lot of different serious issues in MASH, whether it was loneliness or, you know, homesick, or whatever. All of those things were... touched on, or maybe gone into more deeply. So,
well, and you know, I think you're a bit younger than me, so you don't remember, I don't think, the Vietnam era. But MASH came out during the Vietnam era. And MASH was a response to Vietnam, but they set it in Korea because they couldn't really set it in Vietnam given the situation in this country at the time. In the situation with Vietnam.
Okay, I did not really know that. Of course, it makes sense. But
I think MASH started in like 69 or 70, 71. It was during Vietnam that MASH started.
Oh, okay. And the Korean War was in the 50s.
Early 50s, yeah.
So, okay. All right, no, well, then that totally makes sense. And who knows? I mean, maybe that had something to do with the people and the protests and finally getting out of Vietnam.
It certainly was part of the whole milieu that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even, and I'm a big Star Trek fan, you even go back to the old Star Trek episodes that ran, the original that ran like 67 to 68. There are a lot of themes in Star Trek that what they did is they couched things like racism and they put it in the future and these different things they did during, because they couldn't say it outright. It had to be under the radar, so to speak.
Right, sort of covert. That makes sense. I mean, and there, so those kind of things, I mean, even though I threw out the TVs, I still do understand that movies and some television shows are getting points across, that they're not always totally just for giggles.
Yeah.
that there can be a point to them. But, you know, we've been talking about socialism and the wars and the people, and you mentioned the I just wanted to say the veterans, what is it, Veterans for Peace. There's a lot of groups, like you said, that are people who have served who are really against war. So I'm kudos to them. I think it's great. But I wanted to ask, what do you think about socialism? I mean, like the socialist parties in our country. For me, it seems very discouraging. I don't see leaders emerging. I don't see the different parties agreeing to even talk much.
And certainly I'm glad you brought it up, because there are so many different socialist organizations in this country. And you're right, they differ on one or two little points. One is a Trotskyist, one is this. But instead of coming together as a coalition and working for change together despite some differences, they splinter. I happen to belong to the Socialist Party USA, which is located out of New York.
Right.
Greg Payson is the national secretary. But just because I belong to that, my organization down here, even though I'm a member of Socialist Party USA, is called Socialists of South Carolina. We welcome anyone in. We don't care what their party affiliation is. We're trying to build a coalition of people with like-mindedness. Yeah, we may disagree on this or that minor issue, but we're all for socialism in the core beliefs of socialism. It's kind of like Christian churches. How many different denominations are there in Christianity? Thousands and thousands, right?
Thousands upon thousands, yes.
Right. But, they all have a certain core belief for the most part.
Right.
And yet they differ on certain doctrinal beliefs.
Yeah.
And socialism, the socialist parties in the United States and the Marxist organizations and even the communist organizations, I'm just putting them all together.
Yeah,
have a core belief. We differ on certain, maybe I call them doctrinal issues, but you know what I'm saying. Certain small issues.
Yeah.
People won't come together. They get angry at each other. Like, this is the way we have to do it. This is the way we have to do it. Instead of saying, well, let's find common ground and work together to do this. It's like a big thing now with this NSA and spying. I see this a great opportunity of people on the left to actually unite with people on the right over this.
It affects all
of us.
It does. I mean, and we've seen that with the a lot of the right wing people who just found out they were spied upon, the groups, and so we know that they are looking at the lefties. So, sure, it's across the board. Well,
IRS thing is a good example of it. Okay,
yes,
they went after the Tea Parties on this, which was wrong. And I'm going to say outright, it was wrong
to go after them. Yeah,
but,
definitely.
This is a thing the left and the right can unite on, because it's like the old poem that when they came for the communists, I did not speak because I was not a communist.
Yes.
If they're going to go after the Tea Parties, they're going to go after the people on the left, too.
Exactly. That's it, and we need to be uniting behind that. But, I just do not see leadership. I guess I probably know more about the Socialist Party USA than any other because of Stuart Alexander, who has been a candidate for president, and he has a show on this network on Mondays. And I know he has found it sometimes hard. He has asked different people from different socialist parties to be a guest, and they don't want to because he's socialist, Party USA. And that seems so...
Between me and you, I had a few people, between me and you and the thousands listening, I had a few people tell me, you're not going to go on her show because she's this or she's that.
Yeah.
About you.
Yeah.
And there's some people in the Socialist Party USA don't like you. I'm going to tell you probably already know that.
Oh, I know. One of them, Greg, I'll just say Greg Payson was telling lies about me. that, you know, so I realize that. But, you know, Stuart and I, we had a show, we addressed it so people could figure it out for themselves. And if they were too ignorant to do that, well, then it's on them. But,
well, you know, and other people told me, well, you know, she disagrees with you on Israel. I said, well, gee, that's why I want to go on a show, because I want to present a different viewpoint on Israel.
We don't agree,
you know,
on it.
I mean, why not? That's what dialogue is about.
Exactly. Exactly. And
if,
you know,
there was more dialogue on the left, we'd accomplish more things.
Well, the thing is, there's still so many things that we agree on as a base. And, you know, we need to have some kind of leadership so that we can get somewhere and then we can iron out all this periphery stuff. But Well, Stuart had somebody from the Socialist Party USA who was one of the national officers, we'll just put it that way. And we asked this person, so who speaks for the Socialist Party? And this person hemmed and hawed and said, well, I don't know. I guess I could. And we're like, what, you mean there's no speaker? There's nobody that you can put up to do PR or anything? Like, well, I guess I could, kind of thing.
I tell you who's emerging. I tell you who I think is emerging. Pat Noble.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on that. Okay.
Pat Noble got elected to the school board in New Jersey. He's a young guy in his early 20s, a member of Socialist Party USA, and he is really emerging as an individual with a political future, I think.
Okay.
I'm very impressed with the young man. He's Red Bank School Board. He's on the Red Bank School Board. He ran as an open socialist and got elected to the school board in New Jersey. Which actually brings me to something else. I know it's great that Stuart Alexander runs for president, but he's not on every ballot in every state.
Well, right, exactly.
But I think socialism needs to be built on the grassroots level.
Exactly.
We need to get elected to school boards, to town councils, state representatives.
Right, yeah. You've got to start where you are. I mean, or just, you know, your alderman person or whatever. In your small town, large town, wherever. That's where you've got to start. We still need some national leadership, but I'm very glad that you mentioned Pat, because hopefully, and I mean, we had a few young people. Justin Jones is one. Several people are encouraging him. He actually I think his birthday is the same as Stuart, so he's 19 now. But he's been really, he makes videos and different things, and a lot of people have been encouraging him to really think about going into politics. There's a lot of younger people who are interested. And the great thing there, Patrick, is they weren't really taught all the stuff we were.
Mm-hmm.
About the socialists and communists, not so much, not like we were, and that's a good thing.
And I think what's happening in this country is I want to see more of this. I want to see more coalition between the socialists, the people on the left, and the Green Party. I think there's a lot of potential for coalitions there, even though the Green Party tends to be somewhat corporate, and I recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
They're certainly preferable to the Democrats and Republicans. And I think, you know, especially on a local level, I think socialists and Greens can kind of unite. I've done a lot of work with the Green Party locally in the Charleston, South Carolina area, trying to build coalitions. Because we don't obviously have a ballot line here for the Socialist Party. A lot of times we'll support the Green Party candidate and, you know, openly endorse the Green Party candidate if they want the endorsement.
Right.
And that builds coalitions. And I've even considered, and I may consider next year, depending on my health situation, of running for Congress on the Green Party ticket. And I got a little bit of flack from that. But, you know, the thing is, we need to build those coalitions.
Yeah. Yeah, what you say is true. I mean, I was turned off because of the well, the capitalistic bent of the Green Party, but you're right as far as it's better than the Uniparty, which is what I call the Dems and Republicans.
Yeah.
And a lot of socialists that I do know are affiliated in some way or another with the Green Party because they think that it's just a good collaboration, like you said.
And the thing is, you know, what you got to look at is individual Greens that you're going to collaborate with. Now, the guy who ran as Green Party candidate for Congress here in that special election, I did not support him. And we supported the guy who was running in their convention, what they would call a primary, but it was a convention, you know, where they selected the Green Party candidate. We supported a guy called Larry Carter Center, who is a socialist, but also a Green. His significant other is up high up in the Green Party in South Carolina. And we supported him, but when this guy, Eugene Platt, got the nomination, Eugene Platt had come out about against marriage equality, he'd come out against several different things, and he certainly was not somebody we could support. So on an individual basis, too, is where we build our coalitions. We don't necessarily support everyone in the Green Party.
Right.
Now,
right.
I like Jill Stein. I think she's a pretty cool character. Who ran for president of the Green Party in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And because I live in South Carolina, I didn't have the choice to vote for the Socialist Party candidate because he wasn't on the ballot here, so I voted for Jill Stein.
Right.
Because she was the better of the candidates.
Yeah. Well, okay, now
to be realistic.
I was going to say, you opened it up. I just have to do a plug for Brian's and my show, Progress Toward Democracy, coming up this coming Monday. We have Richard Wolff, who serves as her economic advisor, and he's a Marxist economist. So he's another person who is, you know, into the Green Party thing, too. So just a plug, sorry.
No, that's fine. No, and see, that's what I'm saying about the Green Party. I mean, just because I'm a socialist doesn't mean I'm not a realist.
Exactly. Yeah, we may be more real than a lot of others. Yeah.
But I also believe in the axiom coined by Eugene Debs, who is one of the great socialists of all times in the United States, that I would rather vote for something I believe in and not get it than vote for something I don't believe in and get it.
Yeah.
You know. So, and if we had, Eugene Debs got 2 million votes in 1912.
And he was in prison.
And he was in prison, that's right. And he got 2 million votes.
Yeah. So can you imagine? I mean, and let's remember, 1912, over 100 years ago, the population in this country was nothing like it is now, 315 million. And so 2 million was quite a chunk, let's face it.
I want to say he got like 6 or 7% of the vote. I'd have to look it up. I don't know
that for a fact. We have to look at the population at that time. But yeah, I mean that's so impressive. So it's going to happen. But we've only got 15 minutes, and I wanted to talk about Palestine and Israel. And you, I believe, are for a two-state, well, you say you don't care as long as there's peace, but you would be more for a two-state solution, I think.
I think a two-state solution is probably the only thing that's going to work. I'm really for a one-state solution where everyone has rights, but
yes.
I think that's a utopian idea that will never happen. So I think the best solution is going to be a two-state solution where Palestine recognizes Israel's right to exist, Israel recognizes Palestine as a sovereign nation, and maybe they could be united in an economic cooperation like the EU or something of that nature. But we've got to get the radicals out of the picture on both sides. We've got to get Hamas out of the picture. We've got to get these radical people controlling the Knesset that just don't want peace. And we've got to stop building settlements. I mean, I was just having this conversation with a friend of mine in Israel. And he told me, he said, if you drive through Israel, there are so many open spaces, there are so many places that places could be built, and yet these radicals want to build on land that the Palestinians claim that's, you know, the, in the occupied areas, and that is a big barrier to peace.
Well, that I think that that is against international law anyway, building in occupied territories. But I just the whole logistics, because Palestine is in two different parts. I mean, now the occupied part, we've got the West Bank, we've got Gaza, and they do not adjoin. So the idea of a bridge connecting or something to me just seems totally nuts, because I think it would last about 5 seconds before somebody blew it up. I just can't see that working.
I just, you know, the thing is, you know, here, you know, my whole thing is I support Israel, not necessarily the policies of the government. And I always tell people that, because I say I support America, but not necessarily the policies of the government, you know, as an American as well. But we just got to have some kind of lasting solution with the radicals. I think that Abbas in Palestine, I think he's a good man who wants peace. But we have, unfortunately, people in Israel that are controlling the agenda. The ultra-Orthodox, for example, are controlling the agenda. And the problem is we're not going to have peace till we can get the radicals out of the way. How that's done, I don't know. If I had the solution, I guess I'd win the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. But, well, you know what? I mean, after after the president of this country won it, to me, it went way down in you know what I'm saying, but no, I know what you're saying too. I mean, we need some type of peace. I don't know. We talked quite a bit. Well, my friend Sarit, who is from Israel, and she was in the IDF till she managed to get herself out, and she talks on one of the shows here every week with, not every week with the activists, but she's had several Israeli activists for Palestine on the show. And to me, these people are really heroes, because they've lost their jobs or they can't get hired. Some of them have been disowned. They've been beat up. All of these things. And she talks about the number of Israelis who are in jail that you never hear about, who are there because they're pro-Palestine. And that doesn't mean that they are all wanting a one-state solution, although a lot of them do. But they're against the government. But they're against the government for other reasons, too. I mean, I've seen all these strikes that the people are on. There's a lot of poor people in Israel.
Oh, yes, there are.
Did you know now? She had just found out, I believe, at least I had just found out from her, that evidently Germany still sends reparation money to Israel for the Holocaust victim. And
yeah,
they send it to the government, and then the government is supposed to give it to the victim. But a lot of them have not been getting their money. And she said
that is
a crime in itself. I mean, a whole other crime that they haven't been getting paid, basically. So I don't know. I'll ask her for some more information on that. But that's horrifying that, you know, that you would steal from the people who, I mean, these are old people. Let's get real now. I mean, it's not that they're 100 years old, but they have some age. And if they were alive during the Holocaust and they were, you know, victims of it, even if they were, they'd be like 70 years old or something if they were born.
Well, the youngest Holocaust survivor I personally know is 78, and she was a child during the war when she was in camp. So, they're all in their late 70s, mid-70s to 90s and whatnot.
Yeah.
They caught an SS commander in Minnesota this yesterday or something. Still a war criminal, still alive in his 90s in Minnesota.
Wow. Okay, I didn't see it.
I saw that today.
Wow.
Oh,
yeah, because we think that all of these people have passed on, but that's not the case.
Well, there's still some alive. There's still some alive.
Yeah. No, Israel has, somebody else was telling me about some of the good things, and I said, well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm super impressed about, you know, Israel has a lot of vegans, and I'm vegan, And I don't know if you know much about the movement or the 269 Life movement that started in Israel, but they're really conscious of all these things. So this is why I say, you know, the only reason that you get people to hate other people and try to murder them is by dehumanizing them. And
Absolutely. And
all armies around the world do this. So, I mean, if we stop there again, go back to wars. I mean, we stop the war machine, we're going to stop a lot of this. But that's why people do. They think that the people are lower than them, or they call them animals, whatever. And so then they aren't recognizing the humanity, you know, in this person's eyes, that they've got a mother and a wife or a brother or sister or whatever, just like I do.
Yeah. And so, you know, and that's unfortunately what's happened with the Palestinians is they have been dehumanized. And I'm not even going to say Palestinians. Muslims in general.
Right,
in
and Arabs in particular. Yeah.
We dehumanize Muslims. Oh, all Muslims are bad. All Muslims are bad. Well, you know what? I had a roommate in college who was a Shiite Muslim. We got along just fine.
Oh, yeah.
I had a friend in the Philippines who was a local imam, and we used to have coffee all the time in the morning. And we got along just fine, this Jew and this imam. You know,
yeah.
We got along just fine. We disagreed on some things, don't get me wrong. But were friends.
Yeah, right. I mean, we don't, you know, if we agree with every single thing, with our friends or our spouses or whatever, I mean, why, you know, it's just a clone of yourself. You know,
exactly.
I mean, that's no fun. So we've got to have some disagreements, and we learn, though. Because as long as we keep the open mind, we're going to learn. We can figure things out. But we've just got a few minutes. I'd like to ask you then, what do you see, say, in the next 5 years for Palestine and Israel? And then I want to know what you see it with, like, say, the next election or by 2020, in the socialist movement in the United States? Two questions.
Well, Palestine and Israel, I think there's a strong movement towards peace there. I don't know if it's going to happen in 5 years. That would be nice. I'm not sure that it's going to happen in 5 years. But I think a big part of that's going to be, going into your other question, come 2016, come 2020, if we can get people in our government, may not be necessarily socialist, but people who have they truly want peace in the world. We
yes.
may be able to move the peace process forward. You know, people criticized Jimmy Carter when he was president, and yet he did more for peace over there than any other president in history.
I think so. I admire him. He's still at the age of whatever. He is affiliated with Humanity for Habitat, or Habitat for Humanity, sorry. And also, he still teaches in Africa and different places. I mean, actually, he teaches peanut farming and other things.
Yep.
But, and they have the Carter, what is it, the Carter Institute for, like, fair elections. They were one of the first that came out and said that Venezuela has, like, the most honest elections. I mean, you know, he is our one president who actually really cares about people and is doing things for humanity.
I will give Bill Clinton some kudos in that regard too. He has that global initiative, and that has
mm-hmm.
done some wonderful things in the world. I think it's funny that an ex-president in sense almost has more power, because they've got that freedom of, they're not representing the government, they're not beholden to these special
exactly.
interests anymore. And, you know, Bill Clinton has done some great things since he left office. Now, I didn't think he was that great a president.
That's true. And I guess it depends on the circumstances, too, of just the world situation. It's sort of that circular thing when somebody is in office. I mean, they affect it, but it affects them, too. But like you said, once he steps out of that, it's a whole new ballgame.
So I think there are some movements, and I think the socialist movement is going to grow in this country over the next 15 years or so.
I think so.
You know, I'm 56. I don't know if I'll live to see a real socialist state in this country. I probably won't live to see it, but I hopefully will live long enough to help build the foundations of it. I mean, I really do think the young people are coming around. Well, and here's a big revolution, the internet.
Yes, yes. Thank
no longer is the control of a few multimedia corporations. The internet has opened the world, and people can research anything. Just like this show that we're talking on right now. Anyone in the world can be listening to us.
Exactly. We have listeners
around
the world. Yeah, yeah. And it's important.
You know,
I just want to say, not just this show, but support your local and not so local alternative media, because that's where you're going to get information on what's really happening. Don't depend on mainstream media. Because
no, I don't.
It's messed up.
You know, I mean, the best one in the mainstream is MSNBC. They have, you know, Lawrence O'Donnell is an avowed socialist. I don't know if you know that. He has a 10 o'clock show during the week.
Yeah.
And he has come out and said that he is a socialist. So you have a few bright spots in the, quote, mainstream media, but for the most part, you have corporate television controlled by the corporations that own the mainstream media.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's it. It's supposedly about 6 companies own all mainstream media. So whether it's your TV or the news print or what, it all at the end goes back to the same few people, which is disgusting. But Patrick, our time is up, and I want to thank you so much for coming. I always like it when you come on. And yeah, don't listen to those Socialist Party USA people. Come on. I enjoy having you here. So.
And no one, I don't drink the Kool-Aid anywhere, okay? I don't drink the Kool-Aid anywhere.
That's a good thing, because look what happens when people do. www.socialistpartysc.org, and you can find out more about what Patrick's doing in South Carolina. And he'll be back, and we'll be talking more about socialism, Palestine, Israel. We're going to talk about something else and surprise people one of these nights. So.
Already, we won't say what it is, but
no.
We'll have a good conversation in that.
That's right. Okay, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello?
Hello and welcome once again to Feed Your Head. And let me do these disclaimers and we're going to get on with our guests then. Always have to do disclaimers.
You're listening to Aramarte Theo on blogtalkradio.com.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And I have Dr. Mohammed Malkawi with us again. Hi.
Hi, Rutan. Hi, how are you? And
I am great. You're at the airport.
Yes, I am at the airport waiting for my flight, which will take off in about 90 minutes from right now.
Okay. Is it going to be long? I mean, how many hours?
It's a 12 hours of flight. Well, it's very long flight from Chicago to Amman, Jordan.
Okay. So, well, it's going to be nice to get there, see more family, and get away from here. little change of scenery is always good.
Definitely. Thank you.
Well, you are the author of The Fall of Capitalism and Rise of Islam. We've talked about that before. And yes, I just want to say that you did get your bachelor's from the Soviet Union, your master's from Jordan, and your PhD from the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana.
That's correct, yes.
You do lecture here and abroad on economic and political issues. And tonight we were going to talk more about terrorism. Because
a very interesting topic, very exciting topic. Yes.
It is. It's very exciting, and it's so misunderstood. And
yeah.
You know, different people, different perspectives, because I think terrorist is another person, freedom fighter. So
yes.
What is a working definition of terrorism?
Well, believe it or not, the ones who started the definition of terrorism back in the late 70s of the previous century were the members from the CIA and MI6, the British intelligence, and some of the French intelligence. They actually gathered in a three-day conference in Europe to come up with some definition of for terrorism, and eventually came up with a very broad definition, a definition that they can use to label almost any group. And actually, they I can summarize that the way they came up with the definition. It is any violent material acts that are done to pursue political objectives. So this is very broad definition, which does not really anyone for that person, for that matter, almost any group that has that oppressed group in Palestine, in China, in the Middle East, in Latin America can be labeled as terrorist, or for that matter, any state which is state-sponsored terrorism can be. Pardoned from that definition. So it's so the definition of terrorism from the way it was done, it's absolutely biased, it's not accurate. If I want to give a more precise definition, I would just focus on the terror and the fear which is inculcated in the hearts and the minds of people for unjust reasons. It doesn't matter whether it's...
Well, and most of it is unjust anyway, because like if they're saying that, I mean, like you said, that definition is so broad, you could,
yeah.
I mean, it's already stretched out there. Anything can be called terrorism, but right now we have so many supposed terrorists around the world, and in this country, they're most of them are being labeled terrorists. If they're Muslim, so that
yeah.
seems
you know. That seems a trend which they started actually building a case against Muslims and the Islamic religion back in the early 80s when Israel invaded Lebanon and drove the Palestinians out from the Lebanese border, and then some of the reaction to those events, they started calling them terrorists. And by the way, I just want to mention that before 1978, before the CIA MI6 definition, the only ones who used to use the word terrorism and terrorists were the Israelis. They used to label the Palestinian fighters as terrorists. But
no,
the world then did, yeah. The world did not adopt the Israeli definition until the late 70s. They started using that. But I want to make sure that we people understand one thing. Terrorism, whether it's according to the wrong definitions or to the more broader, which is more accurate definition, when people are put in a situation of fear, unjustly and for no reason, that is bad, that's wrong, that should not happen.
Yeah.
and the what should be the focus should be, what is the environment that creates this type of terror? Who creates this environment, and for whose benefit? Who is benefiting from the people living in continuous fear in Africa because of the AIDS and the social diseases? Who benefits from the continuous fear of the Palestinians being bombarded in Gaza and Ramallah and other places? Who benefits from that? Who benefits from the continuous fear that the Muslims in this country, in the United States and abroad, are in continuous fear all the time? Some group, some party, someone, somehow, actually benefits from this continuous fear. That should be exposed. People should really expose that type of environment and the one who benefits from this fear.
Well, isn't that a case of follow the money? Pretty much.
It is. Yeah. Well, it is follow the money, but the way they do that, and this is probably the psychology of I would call it the psychology of devil or evil, is first I will scare you. I will put you under condition that you are frightened. And then you have to follow me. In Arabic, there is a very interesting saying. They say the hyena, the way the hyena eats its prey, it dances, it makes all types of move until the prey comes under fear. It becomes fearful. Once the prey is scared, then the hyena can eat it. Can take it away to its own cave and eat it. And they have all types of mythology on this issue. So the idea is, and this is very interesting, when we grew up, that's how our elderly used to tell us, that the hyena, don't be afraid of the hyena, because if you do, it will eat you. We grew up in villages, in forests, in places where hyenas, they used to come by. And that's exactly how capitalism and the United States and Britain and France are doing. Now, in the Muslim world, in general, it's a world that is full of resources, oil, gas, strategic pathways, waterways. It's abundance of resources. There is a religion, there is ideology, there are values. There are all types of things. Now, for this type of world, the Muslim world, to follow the IMF and to follow the World Bank, IMF is the International Monetary Fund, and to follow the orders of the Security Council, and to really follow with complete submission, they have to be put under fear. Someone has to scare them. They have to be frightened from within. And
right.
This fright, being frightened from within, the moment you start labeling me with terrorism, and therefore I am afraid of this world, because if I get labeled with terrorism, I end up in Guantanamo, I end up in all types of atrocities. I don't need that. So you put me under fear, and then you can do whatever you want. And that is exactly what I was referring to. Someone has a strategic benefit from putting the world in this type of fear situation.
Right.
Actually, the one who's causing the fear is not so-called terrorism or the terrorists, are the ones who are labeled and who are accused or who are afraid of being labeled. These are the ones who are in continuous fear, and these are the ones who are supposed to follow.
Right. So the benefit can just be in the form of controlling the population or whatever.
Of course. Yeah. When you control the population, then you can take whatever you want from that population. It's just like even in small organizations or groups. If someone is a monopolist and is a control freak, he continuously leaves the people, especially in gangs. You know, this is how gangs actually flourish. Members come in, then they are fearful for their lives. Then they are willing to commit any type of crime just to survive. And that is also, if we want to get even more deeper, those who are recruited for terrorism, they have been put in all types of fear situations, fear for their life, fear for their land, fear for their children, fear for their money, for their property, for their work. And then once they are in this situation, you can recruit them for anything, for organized crime, for terrorism, for political violence, for all types of things. And that is really an environment which is a sick environment. It's inhumane environment, and those who create it, they really are creating it in like the devil would do in any situation. And that and
ladies and gentlemen, this is the final morning call for Etihad Airways flight 150 to Abu Dhabi. Our remaining guests are requested to go to gate M90 for immediate departure. Once again, final morning call for Etihad Airways flight 150 to Abu Dhabi. Our remaining guests are requested to proceed immediately to gate M19.
There is a noise on.
Okay. Right. But we know you're okay at the airport, so.
Okay, fine. At least that gives a little bit of different atmosphere for our audience, hopefully.
Right.
May
but,
I mention the terminal, please? Turkish Airlines passengers who arrived in Chicago on a connecting flight
my
and are still holding a United Airlines or American Airlines boarding pass.
Well,
and
if you look at the last 100 years,
Chicago are required
what
to
happened?
A mandatory pass for registration.
First World War,
which
are
already holding a red and white Turkish Airlines boarding pass, do not need to do so.
Is it too loud on the radio? You know, I have been sitting here for about 30 minutes. I did not hear these announcements. They just started.
Probably not until now. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, going back to our topic, in the last 100 years, look at the First World War, which someone labeled it as man-made hell on Earth. Immediately after the end of the war, what happened? There is all types of colonization that took place. Middle East fell under Britain, France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, all of them, they just jumped on Africa and the Middle East, chopped it off, and each one picked a piece. Second World War, same thing. The war ended. The United States created the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. They started giving loans, oppressive loans, not good loans.
Once again, this is the final morning call for Etihad Airways flight 150 to Abu Dhabi. Our remaining guests are requested to proceed to gate M19 for immediate departures. Once again, final morning call for Etihad Airways flight 150 to Abu Dhabi. Our remaining guests are requested to proceed immediately to gate M19.
Sorry about that. This is
it's not your
okay.
fault. No, I mean, we wanted to
not my
interview,
fault,
but okay.
So the Second World War ends, and then immediately you have these moguls of the IMF and the World Bank who have exploited the world until today. And because of everybody was broke, even Europe was broke, Soviet Union was broke, Germany was broke, the United States came as the only country which was not broke out of the war, and it started using the all of these reaping the benefits of the war. And it has become as a tendency, if you run into very harsh, difficult economies, just to create a war and that will solve your problems. And that's in the United States, many people even believe that. Even they, towards 2001, which is they call it the September 11th, and then the two wars that took place beyond that, Afghanistan and Iraq, many think of them as these are wars for economic rebuild. Actually, to be even more specific, I remember 1991 when the United States had the war against Iraq after the occupation of Kuwait. James Baker was trying to explain the reasons of the war. Why are we going there? And then in one of his statements, he was saying, it is about jobs. It's about creating jobs, simply stated. So he is launching a whole war against a country, terrorizing millions of people, killing more than 1 million child because of sanctions. For what? To create jobs for people who don't have jobs. That is insane. That is terrorism, I call it. I call that... And if you look at the Second World War II, the war was over Germany surrendered, Japan was about to surrender, there were notes that it was going to surrender, still we chose to bombard them with a nuclear bomb. What? Why? To put the Japanese and the Chinese and the rest under continuous fear that any time you may go against the big giant, you are going to face destruction. And that is what I call it, real terrorism. And in my book, I talked about that, and in the article I wrote about terrorism, I said the forms of terrorism include economic terrorism, financial terrorism, hunger terrorism, social terrorism. The likelihood that I would be hit by a terrorist in Boston or New York is less than the likelihood of me being hit by a meteorite falling from the sky. It's amazing. Then why do I have to worry about an incident that may never happen in my lifetime for me, whereas I continue to face economic to face on a daily basis that I would lose my job and I would lose my home, then I probably would lose my family. This is a continuous fear. There are millions of people who are facing that every day. Every day there are women who are battled in the United States and in the world at large because of discrimination against women. That is terrorism. That's social terror. Amazingly, it's not Islam that's responsible for that. It's not the Muslims who are not, and it's not Christians for that matter. It is the discrimination based on sex or based on color, which is, at the end of the day, it's a money discrimination. At the end of the day, it's really financial. It's power versus weak, the powerful versus the weak, or whoever they think the weak.
That's what it's all about. But you're right. There's so many forms of terrorism. But yeah, if somebody mentions a terrorist or terrorism, they immediately what we've been supposedly taught or what jumps into people's minds because of misinformation is a picture of a radical Muslim with some kind of a grenade or something. You know that's the majority of Americans think. And like you said, I mean, a terrorist, this is somebody who's beating up on women or, you know, a serial killer or something. But this is a terrorist.
That's a terrorist. Terrorism has nothing to do with religion. Now, religions can be used to recruit people to make them terrorists, because religion, in the absence of a good, fair system, religion, it's a tool. It can be used as a tool. You go to Afghanistan or Pakistan, people are deprived. They don't have homes. Their land is occupied. In order to recruit some people, it's easy. You can go and recruit. Just like you can recruit in the slums of Chicago someone to commit a crime or to sell drugs. You may not be able to recruit someone from, let's say, Port Beach, California. It's very difficult because they are living well. But you go to New York, Harlem, New York, you go to South Side, Chicago, you go North Side, Milwaukee, you can recruit thousands of people to commit all types of crimes. Similarly, you go to Palestine, I was thinking before you called me, someone who for the last 65 years living in a refugee camp in Gaza or in Jordan or in Syria, born and dying in camp. And those refugee camps, if you ever visit them or see them, these are like worse than slums. There is no sewage, there is no water, there is no shelter, there is no conditioning, there is no heat, there is no streets, there is nothing. Absolutely, this is absolutely a harsh environment.
Now, very harsh.
To recruit someone from there to commit anything, that's easy. And so what I'm saying is the one who created this environment, who kicked millions of people out of their homes from Palestine, which is the Israelis, these are the terrorists, not the Palestinians who live in the slums and you can recruit them. That is ridiculous. They should never be called terrorists. The terrorist is the one who drove them out of their home. The terrorist is the one who drove many Iraqis or Syria today in this ongoing revolution. Now, people are living in absolutely harsh conditions. If someone out of frustration would take a grenade and throw it at a policeman, I would call that a terrorist. I would call the one who drove him out of his home, Bashar al-Assad and his regime, these are the terrorists. These are the ones who are killing the people for the sake of sustaining their power. And the one who is actually supporting Bashar, which I believe is the United States, it's Britain, it's France, it's Russia, all of these are supporting. It's not only Russia and China. Russia are supporting Bashar for the foreign minister of Lavrov of Russia was saying, what we are doing, the veto we are doing against Syria, against the Security Council, would make the people in the West happy. That makes some officials in the West happy. So the whole issue of the people in Syria and the revolution, that is a great terrorism happening now. And if someone carries an arm and you call that terrorist, that is absolutely insane. That's ridiculous. That should not be the case. And that is the current world we live in. Unfortunately, not many people speak their mind the way you are promoting this this talk on your radio show. And many people hesitate to come even on this radio show and speak their mind because they would be labeled.
Because I know.
I would be labeled. In my way back from Jordan to this airport, I will be probably summoned at the airport for talking, for pointing a finger to the real who is the real terrorist.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is true, and I like your example of like Southside Chicago or Northside Milwaukee, and along with the people in the camps, because when people have been beaten down so far, like you say, it's not that hard to get them to do something that somebody else is going to label terrorism, and I think people need to realize that we're not. Usually the terrorists don't come from, well, you gave an example of a rich community in California. You're probably not going to find them there. Because it would be harder. They have so much. I mean, they don't have to go looking for a cause or whatever to do. But you travel around the world, and what do you find when you talk about terrorists? Do people in other countries get it the way you're explaining it, or are they sort of closed like so many people in this country?
Well, believe it or not, the majority of the people in the world, except Britain in particular, and the United States, they know who the real terrorists are and who creates the environment of terrorism. I was in the Ukraine a couple of months ago, and wherever I talk, people understand that it's insane to call Palestinian or Syrian terrorists when their lands are occupied and their people are displaced. But the reason I bring Britain is a cause of colonialism and destruction in the world. They are the antagonized nations, and they divide and conquer, and they use or abuse religions and ideologies in order to serve their cause. And that's why you will find that in places where Britain had lots of colonization, like in Egypt, in Palestine, in Iraq, and other places, even in Pakistan and India and Bangladesh, you'll find people can be easily diluted, not because of their religion, but because of the almost 100 years era of colonialism of Britain. But to answer the question, the majority of the people in the world really, they have better understanding of the environment of terrorism than we do here in the United States. in the United States, the media, the main media, mainstream media, is very biased. It's very subjective, and it pursues a certain agenda which is not in the interest of the people. And so they hide facts. Like, look at the facts of 9/11. Does anybody have the real facts? Nobody has the real facts. The facts are hidden. Maybe some in the media, they know it, but they hide it. So the
right.
So the facts, even in the latest incident in Boston, once the incident takes place, then immediately they blockade it, and no one is allowed to take photos or to broadcast photos, and all the websites that had any footage of the scene, they will immediately be blocked. How many websites or pictures or photos were taken out of after 9/11? Even the Navy, the Navy had on its website some scenes of the planes, warplanes, who were close to New York and to Boston. The next 2 days later, those photos were taken away. They were never shown.
Exactly. It was totally whitewashed. It was totally taken over. And you're right. We're not going to get it from the government or mainstream media. We're not finding the truth. Unfortunately,
yeah,
there are other groups that are finding it. But, yeah.
Right. And not only that, but they distort the fact that you already have. It's not, they hide things which you don't know, or if you know something, they will start distorting it and,
mm-hmm.
and giving it a different flavor. So in this country, unfortunately, the information is not readily available despite all the internet. Well, think of the latest incident of Verizon. United States government is spying or taking information from Verizon. Is the largest cell phone carrier in the United States, more than 35 million subscribers, or more than 50 million subscribers. So all of these people, all the information is being tapped. Whatever you talk on the phone, whatever you transmit text messages, it's all tapped. That's crazy. That is terrorism. I call that information terrorism. That's knowledge terrorism.
It's immoral. All of these kinds of terrorism you're talking about, in the very first place, it's just immoral. But yeah, that is a form of terrorism.
Because now I am afraid to pick my phone and talk because someone is listening to me. That's fear. See, going back to when you create fear in my heart, whether it's small or large, that is, you are terrorizing me. You are so the whole issue of terror, it should be understood. Once you put fear in my heart for any reason, now I am fearful to talk. Not me necessarily, I talk, I don't care. But there are millions of people who will shy away from making a phone conversation because they know someone is listening.
So it's cramping people's style, of just their ordinary living. They so many of them feel that they just can't anymore. They can't go here or do this or talk to so and so or say something because somebody's spying on them.
Yeah, and let me take even another direction, which is some people could be surprised at this. Even the food industry. Look at this new wave of so-called organic food. If you can afford it, if you have a little bit more money, you go to a store, you buy organic food. Why? Because someone already told you and told us that the other type of food is not healthy. It's not that it's not like the meat is meat. It's cow is a cow. It's God created cows, and they should live. But when man, capitalism, starts invading the environment of the cattle and injecting them with all types of hormones and enzymes and all types of garbage, then I will fear for my health. And then when I cannot afford the healthy food, I know I am getting into a food which is not healthy that could kill me. That's fear. And that's why
people want to start. I'm a vegan, so I'm definitely for the animals there. But even if I weren't, I would be very skeptical of eating the meat that has been so pumped full of things, not even mentioning the torture of the animals. But it's the same with, that's why we're encouraging people to grow everything you can, support your local farmers markets, all these things because of the GMOs in the food.
Which is really, you come to think about it, it's really ridiculous. For me, I am an engineer. I have to worry about my own food and go grow my own tomatoes. I should go blindly to the market and pick some vegetables, potatoes, tomatoes, and I know this is something good that came out from the soil, God creation, and with least intervention or corruption from man. Now, when I know that this is not the case, so either I have to grow my food or I have to live in continuous fear, not only with meat, but with all types of vegetables. And
yeah.
I was speaking to a doctor, a friend of mine, the other day. He was explaining to me how diabetes came by. And then he says there is lots of research that diabetes is man invented. Those companies, the grain companies, who genetically modify the grain, so that they can last longer and they become more crispy, and they last longer, let's say, in cereal for more than a year.
Yeah.
They genetically modified them, and that modification allowed the body to negatively respond to the insulin, so that the body now does not generate its insulin correctly. And that is, now, why do have almost every third person in the world is diabetic?
Yeah.
50% of the world population are diabetic, which is big, that's the worst type of terrorism you can think of. This is a huge terrorism. Anyone of us, once you reach age 40, is almost 90% you will have diabetes or blood pressure. Why? Because of this stupid, idiot type of capitalistic behavior to genetically modify the food. That is a great type of terror. Why do you have to focus? Why do people have to focus on 9/11 when less than 3,000 people died, but they don't focus on millions of people dying every day? Heart attacks because of stress, diabetes, blood pressure, and all of this
right.
is for the sake of the banks and the money laws.
Well, and right, because these genetic modified products have, well, in fact, been really endorsed by this country, although 50 some countries in the world have banned them, but because of the money, this country has not just okayed them, but they've given them the Monsanto Protection Act recently that Obama signed off on.
Believe it or not, there is tons of research were done by people in Harvard and other places were denied publication by the moguls of this country because they show the atrocities that were committed in the name of genetic modification of food.
Mm-hmm. You can see the, and I'm not for using lab animals, but I've seen the pictures, and the ones who have been fed genetic food, they develop tumors, all kinds of things, and they just die within such a very short time as opposed to ones who haven't been fed that. And, you know, the genetically modifying things, you take DNA from two different species and put it together, and some of this stuff makes no sense. They're doing an experiment in Kansas now where they're using human DNA in rice, DNA from liver of humans.
Yeah.
And, you know, this stuff, it doesn't need to be. What one of the reasons they're doing this is because of these big corporate agribusiness farms, because they farm the same crop in thousands upon thousands upon thousands of acres. And so you are definitely more apt to get a crop disease. So then they came up with Roundup, which is a killer of people and bugs. You know, in the old days, people, they had a small plot and they rotated their crops. Where they grew wheat last year, they're going to grow corn this year and back, you know, this kind of thing. And people didn't have to worry about all this. But now, no, you're right. This is a major pain for me. So it is a form of terrorism. There's a lot of people just don't know what to do. They can't afford organic food. They really don't have much space. They live in a city, so they don't have the space. Or even if they live where there's space, they don't have the physical ability. to grow anything, or at least much at all. So what are they going to do? Then they're going to eat this horrible stuff, and then they try to buy whatever kind of supplements they can to offset it. You know, then they're trying to detox. And this is only the people, Muhammad, that know about it. A lot of people don't really get it yet.
Taking the talk into a different direction, which is now I'm a Muslim. As you mentioned, I lived in the Soviet Union, so I know a little bit about socialism. We live in the U.S., there is capitalism.
Right.
The what really bothers me a lot is that the current world order, the way we live in, is trying to lock or close all paths so that humanity does not get out of this whole terror environment. And one issue is when they take this big toll or accusation against Islam. Now, Islam is known for 1300 years until 1924. From 1924 until now, Islam is not in the area, is not ruling the land. But for the previous era, the people have a good amount of history that is, which is really enough of a sample to make a decent rational judgment. When Islam was in power, was ruling, in fact, even going back to the time of Muhammad the Prophet, peace be upon him, all issues of the so-called uncontrolled violent actions were not allowed, absolutely not. Which means, the uncontrolled violent actions, whether it's violent or food or health or actual material or war, all of these actions, if you look at the history, you'll find that this religion, actually this ideology, actually does have a solution to what is called the worries of terrorism today. And that explains to me why the US and the Britain and some Europe are so much opposed to the rise of Islam as an ideology. Because Islam can, well, as much, and I want to be fair, when the Soviet Union was alive, although Soviet Union did not represent socialism totally, but at least it had a check and balance against the capitalist type of terror.
Right.
So today, with the United States and the Western type of world, they don't want to see another ideology that come up that can expose their fallacies, their terror, which is imposed upon the people. So that explains why all of this type accusations every time you people say, let's get Islam a chance to rule, they say, well, that's terrorism, or that is fundamentalism, or that's extremism. And they bring all types of categories so that to deprive the world from yet another ideology that can provide a different model, not necessarily better, but at least a different model from what the world today knows. And that's an important point.
Yeah, it does, because they don't want any alternatives to be offered to people.
Yes, there are no alternatives.
If they were sure it wouldn't work, they wouldn't care if it was offered.
Exactly.
That has some answers, they can't allow that in their own deluded brain.
That's why all of this type of, when I look at Syria, well, there was a revolution in Egypt, in Yemen, in Libya. They allowed everything to materialize and finish in a short period of time. Hosni Mubarak was evicted, Zain al-Abidin bin Ali was evicted, but now Syria, they are holding so tight because the stakes are high, because the people in Syria, they say, we want to live an Islamic way of life, and we will not give in to Israel occupation of either Palestine or the Golan Heights. But that does not fly with the world power. And that explains to me why this big terror, which is I would consider the largest terrorism in this century, since 2001, 2000, is happening in Syria today. And the world is so quiet and so actually participant to the crimes which are committed in Syria.
Yeah.
In less than 2 years, more than 100,000 people killed, more than 5 million people displaced within Syria, more than 3 million displaced in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan. That's a whole nation destroyed. It's a genocide which is happening today. And why?
Yeah.
Why they allow this to happen? Is that because Bashar is good? It's not really because Bashar is good or he, for them, but the alternative that's coming out of Syria is not acceptable. That's why they are not accepting the alternative.
I'm sorry, they're not accepting what?
The alternative, what comes out of Syria,
ah.
The alternative to Bashar is not acceptable to the so-called to the world powers, to the IMF, to the World Bank, to the Security Council, to the
right.
NATO, to the US.
Right.
It's not
right.
acceptable. So let's. It doesn't matter if Bashar kills a million people or 2 million people. Who cares?
They don't care. People are just numbers. No, that's what I say when people will tell me, well, the U.S. goes in to help countries and, you know, bring humanitarian aid and blah, blah, blah. And I say, you know, anything that the U.S. may bring that's humanitarian is an accident. It's not why they're there.
They're
not doing anything for humanitarian purposes. They're doing it for profit and to keep a country destabilized. And now it appears that the U.S. is going to be arming even more than they have been, the mercenaries that have been imported. So it's just disgusting, really. That's terrorism. People have said, you know, and I admit that, you know, I mean, I would have been one of those people several years ago. I've come a long way. Because if somebody would have told me, well, the United States is the greatest terrorist country in the world, I'd have said, what are you talking about? And now I know it to be true. So, you know, people can change. And that's what I'm hoping, that all of the alternative media that's out there, whether, you know, it's radio stations like this, the shows, or people blogging, or with the citizens' news, whatever. I hope that it's waking people up. And I've seen evidence that it is. People are starting to get it. That,
yeah,
you know,
I think the more information comes out, I think people at some point they will get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Being an impatient kind of person, I want them to have gotten it, you know, years and years ago. But, of course. But, you know, it is happening. But what those of us who understand this, what is the best?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Have your attention at the gate. We're journeying to Beijing passenger Kareem Jojur. Passenger Kareem Jojur, please see an agent at gate M4 for a message. Thank you.
Okay. What would you say for us, how best to explain to old friends and neighbors, and when we get into conversations about, and I'm real good about bringing topics up that people might not have in mind. How can we best explain something like this, that the whole idea of terrorism, and I mean, without going into a long explanation or anything, and point out the, you know, would you say, like, to use some of your stories from the, because I'm going to do that, from the bad areas of town or the poor areas of town, how it's easy to recruit. What else would you suggest?
I would go into like the example I mentioned. What is first, number one definition.
Can I have your attention to the terminal, please? Turkish Airlines passengers who have arrived at the Chicago on a connecting flight and are still holding a United Airlines or American Airlines domestic boarding pass and have now checked in with a Turkish Airline representative are required to do a mandatory passport registration at gate M15. Passengers already holding a red and white Turkish Airlines boarding pass do not need to do so Lütfen dikkat, Türk Hava Yolları yolcularından bağlantılı seferde Chicago'ya gelmiş ve Türk Hava Yolları kontrolünde çekiliş işlemi yaptırmamış yolcularınızın pasaport kontrolü için
Turkish. Okay.
There we go. Okay.
No, this was Turkish. I would use the simple examples of why people are fearful. What scares me a lot more, as a normal person who lives in the neighborhood. What really scares me more? Is it a drunken driver who might be drunk at night hitting me or causing me an accident, or someone, a terrorist coming from somewhere in the world, Afghanistan or Mali or wherever, hitting me? What is more fearful to me? What should scare me more? Should scare me more when I go to the hospital and turns me back because my insurance is not enough to pay for my illness? Would that scare me more, or would scare me that someone is putting a pressure cooker somewhere in Boston and exploding it in a marathon once in a lifetime? What would really make my life more miserable in reality? When I wait for my kid to come home and there's a big likelihood that he may not come because of the number of children who are abducted, and those numbers is very high, or they get terrorized at the school, that scares me more. Those are the things that we should be looking for and look at for their causes. And then at the end of the day also is if I have enough to eat and my neighbor doesn't, then I should not be surprised if my neighbor at some point of time, he's going to pick on me. Of course, not necessarily the immediate neighbor, but then the whole neighborhood. If the neighborhood or the country, which is neighborhood can be as large as a city or a state or a country, there is a group of people who see some driving limousines and going in jet planes and eating all types of fancy food, and they are going to the garbage cans. Now, what would prevent these people who are eating from the garbage can at some point to jump into my house or my garden and pick up a piece of fruit? That is the type of thought which we need the people to start thinking about, which means the real environment that allows people to go out of their way to disturb the life of others and to create fear into the life of the others. And this is a two-way stream, because the first, I created fear and terror in the mind of the poor and the heart of the poor and the deprived. Then that poor or deprived can take this back at me and terrorize me a different way. So this cycle has to be broken, this cycle of violence, this cycle of have and have not, this cycle of deprived and the one who depriver, the cycle of the tyrant and the cycle of the oppressed. This has to be ended. And to end this cycle, I think, coming from the perspective of Muslim, I think Islam has a great to offer in this regard. I really want the people to go and re-examine this ideology of Islam, this religion, this deen. And this is not to diminish the Christianity. Christianity, for some reason, gave up for after the Middle Ages, when they had all of this separation of church and the state. They gave up. They just maintain their life in the church. But on the street, the only thing that is still viable today, after the collapse of so-called socialism in the Soviet Union and the current tyranny of capitalism, the viable alternative that's still there is Islam, for people to examine and re-examine and discuss. Maybe there is a solution there, or if not, then let's look for a better solution, which I, as a believer, I don't think there is another one. Okay, Ruthann, can we close in the next minute or so? So I think my plane is boarding.
Ah, Okay, I am so glad you came on, and I know you're going to be boarding probably before then. Mohammed, thank you just so much for coming on, and we'll talk again when you get back from Jordan.
Okay.
And we'll have coffee as soon as you get back.
Good. Thanks for having me again, and we'll definitely have coffee and talk more about all of these issues. Yes.
Right. And I know that Bilal and Elvis will be listening to this too. And they really admire you because they came from Milwaukee to Chicago to hear you the other day. And I heard your speech. It was wonderful. So anyway, my friend, thank you so much.
Okay.
And have a very safe trip.
You too. Bye. Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.